Good afternoon, and welcome to Morgan Lewis Presents 2015, Burning Issues at the SEC. Broadcast live from Morgan Lewis & Bacchius LLP's offices in New York City and online at www.sechistorical.org. I'm Jill Fish, Perry Gulkin Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Institute for Law and Economics at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and I'm the moderator for today's program. Since its debut in 2009, this series has examined current cutting-edge issues in financial regulation of interest to the legal profession. The series is made possible through a partnership between Morgan Lewis and the SEC Historical Society. With the leadership of its more than 2,000 legal professionals in 28 offices in North America, Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, Morgan Lewis provides comprehensive litigation, corporate, finance, restructuring, employment and benefits, and intellectual property services in all major industries. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. The virtual museum and archive is the preeminent online source for original and primary material in the regulation of the capital markets. Previous programs in this series are permanently preserved in the dedicated Morgan Lewis Presents section under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive. Past broadcasts have examined such topics as current issues in broker-dealer enforcement, asset management, criminal enforcement of securities laws, harmonization of the regulation of investment advisors and broker-dealers, and enforcement after the Dodd-Frank Act. All of these are accessible free of charge and worldwide at all times. I encourage you to check them out at the end of this broadcast. The SEC Historical Society is grateful for the generous sponsorship of Morgan Lewis for today's program, which will examine burning issues at the SEC. Joining me on this panel are Timothy Burke, co-leader of Morgan Lewis's Securities Enforcement and Litigation Practice, resident in Boston. Tim also serves on the SEC Historical Society's Board of Trustees. Andrew Calamari, director of the SEC's New York Regional Office. Andrew has been a member of the SEC staff since 2000 and previously served as senior associate director and co-head of enforcement for the New York office. And Mary Jo Gillette, also co-leader with Tim of Morgan Lewis's Securities Enforcement and Litigation Practice. And Mary Jo is resident in both Chicago and Philadelphia. Welcome all. I've had the privilege of working with the presenters to prepare today's discussion, and I want to begin with Andy. Andy, can you start us off by giving us a brief overview of current SEC issues and priorities?
Sure, thank you. I think we're coming up on the end of the fiscal year, so tomorrow is the last day of the fiscal year, and all the statistics and the roundup and the press release are going to be issued in a couple of weeks to follow that. So what I thought I would do tonight is just give you a couple of the highlights from the year, really focusing on what I view as, it's kind of a year of firsts in a number of ways. And so I thought I would just tick off some of the actions that really are new and novel, beginning with the BDO case that we filed a few weeks ago, which was the first action involving admissions by a major auditing firm and the first accounting action against a major accounting firm in the last 6 years. We also brought the first action charging a private equity advisor with misallocating broken deal expenses. That was the KKR matter. The first action for failure to report a material compliance matter to a fund board, which was BlackRock. The Municipal Continuing Disclosure Cooperation Initiative also saw the first 36 cases against underwriting firms. We had our first action against an underwriter for pricing-related fraud in the primary market for municipal securities, which was Edward Jones. First action applying Dodd-Frank provisions limiting the sale of security-based swaps, which was Sand Hill. The first action under the anti-retaliation provisions of the whistleblower statute, KBR. The first action against a major credit rating agency, S&P/Duca. The first FCPA action against a major financial institution, BNY Mellon. And just last week, the first action under the Distribution in Guise initiative, which was First Eagle. And as I say, these were all really first-of-the-kind cases, but, you know, they are part of a much bigger set of cases that really continue in the tradition of what we've always done, including bringing many insider trading cases last year, even after Newman. In the financial fraud space, I think you're starting to see a resurgence in that area. We filed BDO, as I mentioned, Bankrate, Muscle Farm, Kit Digital, CSC, ITT, Deutsche Bank, and a number of others. We've also continued our focus on investment advisors, bringing the KKR, BlackRock, and F-squared cases as some examples. FCPA was also a good year from a case generation point of view. A number of cases were brought in that area. In the market structure area, we've continued to bring actions under the market access rule. We had the largest penalty to date against an ATS, which was the ITG case. And then, of course, there was the hacking action that was announced, I guess, a few weeks ago now, which resulted from collaboration among different components of the commission, including the Market Abuse Unit and the Complex Financial Instruments Unit. I mentioned the Complex Financial Instruments Unit, which has had a very busy year. I mentioned the S&P Duca case. I had also had the ITT matter, Lynn Tilton, and the Nomura RMBS matters. And the pipeline for complex financial instruments is very large. And then one area that may kind of get undersold sometimes is the work of the microcap fraud task force. And that group, which is really now a nationwide group, has just been doing phenomenal work in really making a dent in what is a scourge on the retail investor population, and that is microcap fraud. They've been routinely now suspending trading in securities on almost a weekly basis in addition to various mass trading exercises, but they've also had quite a number of cases that have really been getting behind the scenes in a lot of these truly criminal-type operations. So that work should not go unnoticed. And then, of course, we've had a pretty good year on the trial front with a lot of good judgments, including the $55 million judgment in the Kokesh matter and the $50 million judgment in the Levin matter. Of course, we've had a few losses, too. But for the most part, I think we feel it's been a very good and productive year on the trial front. So kind of in a nutshell, those are the highlights from 2015. And as I say, we're going to be issuing our press release in the next couple of weeks, announcing in a lot more detail a good summary of everything that we've accomplished in the past year. So
it's a pretty amazing two-minute summary and a really broad range of actions. Thank you, Andy. I want to get back to insider trading a little bit later, but I want to turn now to enforcement priorities. During last year's program, Andrew Ceresni, SEC Director of Enforcement, said a lot has been made of the broken windows strategy, but I think what we're really trying to do here is focus on areas that we see as lacking in compliance, that need increased focus in compliance, but it's not going to distract us from our broader mission of protecting investors by punishing misconduct more broadly. I think, Andy, you've given us a pretty clear sense of the broader mission and a lot of the actions outside of compliance. Mary Jo, you've raised some issues about the broken windows policy and the SEC's recent enforcement efforts. What issues do you see the policy raising?
Well, I think that the commission is stuck with the fact that they have pretty flat resources. So when Mary Jo White announced the broken windows philosophy, that meant that they were making a commitment to doing types of cases and bringing types of standalone violations that historically, more often than not, were only charged and brought if they were part of a larger action that included fraud charges in most instances. And so I think that the dilemma for the staff, potentially, and I'd be interested to hear Andy's thoughts on this, is that they now have sort of taken on this broken windows approach, and yet they don't have additional resources. So as a manager, you've got to decide, okay, if I deploy resources to a compliance-based, pick any one of the ones that we've seen, Rule 105 type investigation, that by definition means that I'm not putting those same resources on some other potentially more egregious or more serious violation. And the thing that we have been seeing in the defense bar, and I don't know whether it is an outgrowth of this underlying shift in terms or expansion in terms of priorities, is an increasing use of the examination staff to develop evidence of broken windows type violations. Almost a compression of the examination and enforcement functions in some instances, and then enforcement referrals where with very little or no investigation on the part of the enforcement staff, coming to firms or individuals and basically giving the equivalent of a Wells notice and asking, making a settlement demand. And so, you know, I think that from a policy standpoint, and this is one concern, but I really want to hear whether Andy thinks that there's any merit to that. The examination process historically was created by the commission precisely to allow for a forum outside of enforcement within which firms could get into compliance or resolve compliance deficiencies that weren't necessarily at the level of a full-blown, what was considered at that time, a full-blown enforcement action. And I'm wondering whether we're losing some of that ability to engage in dialogue at the exam level, for firms to use that process to really enhance compliance and strengthen compliance short of an enforcement action. And I'll stop there and let you react, Andy.
Okay. Mary Jo mentioned this on the prep call the other day, this idea of the exam program becoming somewhat conflated with the enforcement effort. And I have to say, and I can only really speak for New York because that's where I'm from, but that is not the way that we do it in New York. I mean, for the most part, you know, there are sometimes discussions between exam and enforcement when, for example, we think there's some big fraud going on and maybe it's happening at a broker-dealer, so enforcement may suggest that the exam program send a team in to look at it. Those kinds of things have been happening ever since the beginning of time. But in terms of a more coordinated effort between exam and enforcement, it hasn't worked out that way for us. And in fact, you know, in my time, I can't really think of an instance where as right out of the box from an exam, we've Wells somebody. That's just not the way. I don't know, maybe you have some specific example that I'm not aware of.
I do, but they're not from the New York office.
Okay. So I really don't think that's the way we're operating, at least in New York. On the bigger picture point, which is broken windows generally, you know, I think broken windows has gotten a bad rap. I think, you know, maybe the moniker isn't all that great.
You prefer stop and frisk?
But, you know, on some level, I really have always regarded these kinds of cases as being really infrastructure cases. I mean, I really see them not as wasting resources, but as helping to, it's like a force multiplier, which is a phrase or a term Mary Jo has used on a number of occasions. Because if you're picking the right areas and you can beef up compliance in particular areas, then, A, you're either going to stop problems from developing or at least you're going to make them easier to detect. Now, you know, people may quibble over what areas we pick to do this in, and anybody can certainly debate those issues. But I think, you know, the real point of it is not to simply bring a case because we can, not to find, you know, any technicality that comes up in a deficiency letter and turn it into a case. I actually think there's a lot of thought that goes into a lot of the initiatives or so-called broken windows cases in terms of what the message is going to be, what the impact is going to be. I mean, just to take for example, and actually it's very interesting because even before, you know, Mary Jo came to the commission and back in the days when I was an associate director on the enforcement side, we used to have our exam referral meetings. And I would always tell the folks on the exam side, don't shy away from good infrastructure cases, because I thought they were important. That doesn't mean bring me all your deficiency letters. It just means that if you have something that you think is a serious compliance problem, you bring that to enforcement, because that's worth pursuing. for the very same reasons. So I really think this is really along those same lines. And again, folks, you know, I know people can throw out examples. Well, why'd you bring that case? Why? And I can't answer all that. I mean, that, you know, everybody can differ on where we make our choices. But I do think the idea is right-headed. I think it's got a good purpose behind it. And it's not just to generate cases.
I guess one of the things that we worry about is if the goal is enhanced compliance, do we pursue that goal effectively by taking an enforcement-oriented approach as opposed to detecting through the exams and otherwise and kind of rehabilitating? And, you know, maybe in that vein, Tim, we've seen a particular focus on chief compliance officers. Can you tell us a little bit about what the trends are there?
Sure.
And the extent to which, you know, we see this enforcement versus rehabilitation dichotomy?
Sure. Thank you, Professor. And you know, one of the, I think, real burning issues that did develop over the last year within SEC enforcement was the cases that they brought against chief compliance officers. And as I imagine everybody in the room knows, the chief compliance officer is the person within an organization responsible for setting the policy and then making sure the policy is being implemented throughout the firm. And the debate is when, if ever, should a chief compliance officer be held responsible for a rule violation of somebody else? And traditionally, the SEC has treaded lightly when it comes to bringing cases against enforcement, chief compliance officers, enforcement cases. But that changed a little bit this year. In April, the SEC filed two high-profile cases against chief compliance officers. The first one, Andy, you alluded this, to this in your list of first impressions, and that's the BlackRock case. The other case was the SFX financial management case, and I'll briefly summarize the facts of both and then hopefully introduce what the debate is that has arisen. In the BlackRock case, BlackRock had a portfolio manager who had an outside business activity. It was a venture, and it was an interest in an oil and gas venture. And according to the SEC's order, BlackRock's legal and compliance department knew about the outside business activity. They reviewed it, and they approved it. And again, according to the order, BlackRock's legal and compliance team considered whether or not that outside business activity created a conflict, a material conflict, that required disclosure to the fund's board. That part of the case is privileged, and the discussions among the lawyers weren't revealed. But the order does say that the decision was made not to advise the fund board about the potential conflict of interest that the portfolio manager had. Now, in the settlement order, the SEC found that BlackRock failed to implement policies and procedures to assess and monitor the outside business activities of its employees and to disclose material conflicts to the board. They didn't just go after BlackRock, but they went after the chief compliance officer as well. And they said that the chief compliance officer in the same settlement document failed to make the required annual disclosure of all material compliance matters to the fund's boards. And that was in violation of Rule 38A1 under the Investment Company Act. The SEC's press release that came out right after the settlement said that that's the first time that the SEC brought a case under Rule 38A1. So in the very first instance where this issue had been brought to the enforcement level, they charged an individual, a chief compliance officer, who was personally fined $60,000. In the SFX advisory case, here we have a very different size investment advisor, very small investment advisor. Maybe you've heard of them. They're well known for representing high net worth individuals and celebrities, mainly professional athletes. And one of the services that SFX provided was to pay bills for its clients who, you know, are wealthy people and, you know, celebrities and don't have the time or inclination to pay their own bills. The problem is the president of SFX decided to use some of his clients' money to pay his own bills. And one of his clients turned out to be Mike Tyson. And think about it. If there's one person who you don't want to steal money from, it's probably Mike Tyson. The SEC charged SFX with inadequate policies and procedures with respect to monitoring the bill-paying services. They also charged the chief compliance officer of SFX for a number of things. But before we get to what he was charged with, the chief compliance officer, in the course of these events, learned about the potential misappropriation when a client complained about a credit card issue. he immediately suspended the president, his boss, who was ultimately terminated, and then reported to the criminal authorities. So from the chief compliance officer's point of view, he's taken pretty extreme measures within a small organization against his own boss, the president of the company. Nevertheless, the SEC charged him for failing to reasonably implement the firm's policies and procedures with respect to the bill-paying services that the company provided. They also charged him, as well as the company, for making material misrepresentations in the way in which the bill-paying services were described on the form ADV brochure, because the ADV brochure said that the accounts from which the bills would be paid would be reviewed weekly or multiple times a week by senior management. That turned out to be true, but the only one that was doing the reviewing was the president who was stealing the money. So therein lies the problem. Now, this created a tremendous amount of debate within the commission and the commissioners themselves. And as I'm sure everybody in the room knows, an SEC settlement requires the approval of the commissioners. And there are five of them, two Democrats, two Republicans, and one presidential appointment. The SEC Commissioner Dan Gallagher, shortly after he voted against the elements of both of these cases that related to the individual charging of the CCOs. And then he took the rare step of issuing a public statement where, in a rather compelling way, he said that he was concerned about the SEC trending towards a strict liability for CCOs under the Advisors Act. And he said he had previously admonished the SEC to tread carefully when bringing enforcement cases against chief compliance officers or other compliance personnel, and that the recent actions that the SEC brought this year flew in the face of those admonitions. He also raised the policy concern that if you're going to charge people for failing to implement policies within their firm, are you creating a structure where you're going to incent people to opt for a lesser standard, to implement lower standards that would be easier to enforce than a higher standard? And does that make a lot of sense from a public policy point of view? As he put it, you want to avoid the incentive to create a lower standard so that you can satisfy it when the government comes along, as he put it, and plays Monday morning quarterback. Commissioner Gallagher's public statement was met with a very equally forceful response from Commissioner Luis Aguilar. Commissioner Aguilar happens to be a Democratic appointment, and I'm not saying this for political reasons. I don't know how politically motivated it is, but I would note that both of them had previously announced that they were stepping down from the commission before they made these kind of public statements. So maybe they were less inhibited. I don't know. But Commissioner Aguilar's comments in response to what Commissioner Gallagher had said was, we're also telling. What Commissioner Aguilar said was that he was concerned that there was dissent within the CCO community about the impression that the SEC is taking, quote, too harsh of an enforcement stance against CCOs, and that CCOs are needlessly under siege from the SEC. He then went on to point out all the good work that chief compliance officers do and the very important investor protection role that they play. And he noted that in his experience in the years that he's served at the SEC, in most cases, the SEC was not charging compliance officers for compliance-related failures. Instead, he pointed out that CCOs were most often charged when they wore multiple hats. In other words, a CCO who is also perhaps a portfolio manager or a CEO or an owner of the investment advisor. So in his view, the SEC was not treading an inappropriate ground. They were acting responsibly and bringing cases that, according to him, the SEC was warranted to bring. Now, coming back to Commissioner Gallagher, Andy, and this is what I wanted to come back to you, he cautioned in his remarks that the SEC should exercise restraint and discretion even when it's deciding to investigate a chief compliance officer or another compliance official. And he went on to emphasize the very real psychological impact when an individual is dragged through a testimony process that can go on for months or even years, a well submission process, negotiations with the staff, and ultimately perhaps, you know, the scarlet letter stigma of an enforcement action. And he suggested that the SEC exercise restraint before setting off on the path for investigating a chief compliance officer. And Andy, I know that at some point in just about every investigation, compliance policies, compliance procedures are going to be subject to scrutiny. But what factors do you and your office take into consideration in deciding whether or not to investigate or even pursue a case against a chief compliance officer or another compliance official?
Let me just distinguish the investigate from pursue, because the investigation, generally speaking, especially when you're dealing with a regulated entity, isn't looking at the compliance officer. It's looking at what's happened. And so whenever you're dealing with a compliance-oriented failure, you're going to be talking to a compliance officer. So I don't know that there's really a practical way to deal with that. I mean, just like anybody else in the firm who's touched the issue, you know, a compliance officer is going to have to sit for testimony. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be. Now, you know, look, I think the debate has obviously, you know, been very, very public. I mean, you've had Commissioners Aguilar and Gallagher out there espousing, you know, different views, although there's also agreement between them on some of the bigger picture issues. And I think that everybody in the commission is very, very sensitive to this issue. And certainly I think this public debate has made that even more true. I do believe that, you know, the public statements out there, which are that we will pursue compliance officers only in three circumstances: one, in which the compliance officer is actively involved in the underlying misconduct; two, where a compliance officer misleads the enforcement division or the commission; or three, where there's a wholesale abdication, not just a mistake, not just negligence in performing your duties, but a wholesale abdication with respect to creating and implementing a compliance program. Those are the three buckets. I think, as Commissioner Aguilar correctly pointed out, I think there's been something like 8 cases against compliance officers in the compliance function in the last, 11 years or something like that. So there aren't that many of these cases. And I do think that, you know, we are now, more than ever before, very keenly tuned into the issue. And I can assure everybody that whenever the question arises whether we should Wells a compliance officer, that issue is getting a great deal of thought. So, you know, none of this is happening in kind of a knee-jerk way. I mean, these decisions are being carefully considered because we get the issue. I mean, we definitely get the issue.
Andy, can I ask you a follow-up to that? Has there been discussion, and if so, how does the commission or the staff look at the issue of one of the things that you hear from the firms and from the industry is that as there's increasingly potential liability for CCOs, that it makes it more difficult to attract and hire people with the highest credentials in those roles. And I'd just be interested to hear, you know, if there's really been a shift in thinking, because I think back to sort of the mid-2000s when the commission was having these what they called CCO outreach programs around the country, and very much the theme in those programs was, you know, we the staff of the SEC want to partner with you, the CCOs, to really, you know, support you and create a strong and compliance environment. And I'm wondering if that's still part of the equation from the staff standpoint, or has that been sort of left behind?
No, that's absolutely right. And you know, I do recognize that the cases that you've just talked about have caused quite a stir. I think that one of the points that Commissioner Aguilar correctly made, and I'm not now going to get into the particulars of any case or suggest anything about any case, but I do think that there is a messaging aspect of this on which we have not done a very good job. I mean, I do think that since we've stated what the buckets are, we ought to be crystal clear in the orders as to why the particular facts fit the bucket. And I think that that is an area that maybe we need to improve upon just so that, you know, the concerns that you're raising can be looked at in a different way, in a different context where you're seeing the facts in a little bit of a different way. So, you know, that I think is where we need to improve. But as I say, I do think that there is a tremendous amount of sensitivity to the issue.
Yeah, I think we're hearing a lot about the sort of demands for individual accountability and greater communication about why this particular individual was and should be held accountable would provide really meaningful guidance to the compliance officers and the people who advise them. So I think that's a terrific idea. Andy, let me shift topics now. I want to ask you a little bit about the broker-dealer task force. The task force was established to develop initiatives in areas like churning, anti-money laundering, and other abusive activities by recidivist brokerage firms. What's been the impact of the task force, and what kind of initiatives is it focusing on?
So the task force was created really kind of to create a vehicle much like the asset management unit is for the investment advisor program. So we have, you know, the investment advisor examination program and the broker-dealer examination program. Investment advisor managers have their arm in enforcement, which is the asset management unit. We had nothing in enforcement that was really comparable. So the task force was created for that reason. And the difference is that the unit is staffed. So they come up with their plan every year. They investigate their cases. They bring their cases. Whereas the task force is really designed to generate referrals that then go out to the regions for either examination or enforcement investigation. And so far, I'd say we've probably sent out 60 to 70 referrals on various topics in the last year and a half or so. And primarily, right now anyway, the focus is on retail issues. So that's not to say that over time that focus won't change, but at least initially we felt that the retail population really needed to get the most attention. And so that's why, as you mentioned, issues like churning, which is a perennial problem, a big problem for certainly many investors, especially elderly investors, is an area of focus. But AML is, and Andrew Ceresni and Kevin Goodman on the exam side, each has given a speech this year on the importance of AML compliance. And that is an area where the task force, and I actually think to some degree some of this actually emanated from the work the task force has been doing, because AML compliance, as Andrew has pointed out, is absolutely essential to feeding the enforcement division information that is necessary to bring and develop cases, sometimes cases that need to be addressed very, very quickly. And what our statistical analysis showed was that despite the fact that you have something like 4,700 or 4,800 broker-dealers out there, there's an awful lot of broker-dealers that don't file any SARs. And when you actually drill down a little bit more to see, you know, where it might make sense, where you might not expect a broker to file SARs because maybe it's a proprietary shop or something like that, and you eliminate all of that still, there's an awful lot of broker-dealers that should be filing SARs. We have to believe should be filing SARs and are not. So the point of the initiative really is to go out there and investigate some of the ones that look like they are the prime suspects, and we've got quite a lot of these referrals out there right now, and see if there are cases that need to be brought. I mean, as Kevin Goodman points out, AML compliance means, to begin with, that you actually have a compliance program, that you have a compliance program that is tailored to your business, that is not an off-the-shelf program, and that you are actively implementing that program in such a way that you're capturing suspicious activity. You know, and to bring these cases, we don't need to prove that a fraud occurred. We just need to prove that a lot of suspicious activity was floating past your AML officer and nobody bothered to file a SAR, or that they filed a SAR, but it was very perfunctory and uninformative, not developed in a way that would really let any reader understand why it's suspicious, or cases where SARs are filed, but they're filed just way too late. So, you know, that's kind of the universe of things we're looking at there. But we really do want to drive home the point, and this is both on the exam and the enforcement side, that AML compliance is something that we are looking at, and it's something that shops really need to get control of and do a much better job of. So,
Andy, yeah. I have a... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead,
Tim.
I was
just going to follow up on one thing. Maybe it's the same thing, Mary Jo. You'd mentioned retail investor issues, and you ticked off churning as one of the retail investor concerns that you've referred out or you've seen referred out. Are there specific products that you've seen come up again and again as part of these referrals that, you know, people ought to be aware that there's an interest at the SEC?
You mean... products that we've got an initiative focused on?
Yes.
I mean, well, one of the initiatives involves the retail sales of alternative products, which can mean a lot of things, but including private placements, those kinds of products. And so there is going to be an initiative that is going to be rolled out very, very shortly, which should include quite a number of referrals, in that, referrals internally to either exam or enforcement. To take a look at some of these shops that are selling these alternative products. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of issues there, one being suitability. You know, you're also looking at compliance in those circumstances as well.
I was going to ask you a question about where the matters come from that the task force looks at. In specifically, is it coming from work that's being done by DERA, and are they analyzing, for example, patterns and outliers to identify firms where you think there may be issues?
The work actually, you know, in enforcement, we have the Office of Market Intelligence, and within the Office of Market Intelligence, we have a Bank Secrecy Act review group. And so a lot, most of the work, most of the analytics has been done by that BSA review group. So they've taken the universe of broker-dealers and analyze pretty much all the SAR filings and the patterns of SAR filings. They've looked at the different demographics, like who are your customers, how many customers do you have, are you a penny stock shop, you know, those kinds of issues. And they've distilled it all down to a manageable universe of first wave referrals for exam and enforcement. And, you know, those are moving along, and there may be more to come on that.
Tim, let me turn to you now. Andy, in his opening remarks, talked about the SEC's recent litigation successes, but they haven't all been successes, have they? And the SEC has made an increasing use of in-house judges to decide cases through administrative proceedings rather than bringing enforcement actions that are litigated in federal court. And this practice has received extensive criticism. Some judges have questioned the legality of the current system, and some commentators have said that the SEC is making use of the administrative proceeding in order to gain a home court advantage and to shield some of its actions from more rigorous judicial oversight. Do you think those concerns are well-founded?
So, Professor Fish, you mentioned that the SEC didn't fare well in all of its cases last year, and while that may be true, you really kind of have to step back and look, where were they playing? Were they playing home or away? Because there's really no place like home for the SEC in terms of how well they do in front of their administrative proceeding officers. That's really, I think, one of the most dramatic changes that came out of the Dodd-Frank Act, because the Dodd-Frank Act opened up the administrative proceedings process to allow the SEC to bring civil monetary penalty cases against individuals who are not regulated persons or entities. So now they can essentially bring any case in either federal district court or in an administrative law judge proceeding, and it's within their discretion and their purview to make that decision. In 2014, and just to give you some sense of how the stats broke down, the SEC was undefeated at home. They went 6-0 in administrative law judge cases. Whereas when they tried cases, litigated cases, to conclusion in the federal district courts, they only won 11 out of 18. Now, as Andy said, the stats for this year are going to be coming out later this month. The official fiscal year for the SEC ends on Wednesday. And they didn't do as well either in the administrative proceeding or the federal court proceeding this year versus last year. But there are some distinct advantages, I believe, to the SEC when they bring a case in an administrative proceeding. And I'll just go through a couple of them and maybe talk about some of the, you know, the issues that of concern that have arisen both with the federal judges and others who have who've questioned the SEC, the fairness of the SEC's bringing these cases in front of administrative law judges. First of all, in terms of advantages to the SEC, there is a very short time clock on an administrative proceeding. Under the current rule, The SEC rules say that from the moment in time when a respondent is sued until the moment in time when there's a decision by an administrative law judge will be 300 days. For those of you who litigate cases, particularly complex cases, that is extremely fast in terms of a timeline. The other advantage is that the current rules don't allow a respondent to take depositions except in the rare case where you have to preserve testimony from a witness that won't be available. So in the ordinary course, the SEC can investigate a case for months and months, frankly, for years. The SEC has the unfettered ability to take as much deposition testimony as it wants before it brings the case. The SEC can subpoena documents and emails and gather, you know, trading records from essentially anywhere in the country. They also have a Wells process where they invite the potential defendant to basically share all of your defenses, lay out how you would defend this case before the SEC then makes the decision as to whether or not they want to go ahead. And then when they finally do decide to go ahead, they get to decide when the clock starts. Now, there were some changes just last week with respect to some proposed rules that I believe were in part to respond to some of the criticism about the potential unfairness of the administrative law judge process. And among the proposed changes, and none of these are have gone into effect yet, they're only in the proposal stage, and even if they were to be proposed now, they wouldn't be effective for another couple of months. But the current rule proposed change is to allow the defendant, or the respondent, as it's referred to in an administrative case, to take up to three depositions. And the SEC also gets to take three more depositions on top of all the ones that they took before they filed the case. In cases where there are multiple respondents, the maximum number of depositions goes all the way up to five. And it's among the respondents to decide who's going to take the depositions of and what witnesses will be deposed. And you can imagine that kind of scenario where you may have, you know, two respondents who, by the time they're both sued by the SEC, may not exactly be playing on the same team. And yet they're going to be limited to a cap of five depositions total between the all of the respondents. There's also a time limit of 6 hours per witness for these depositions. And there is the concept, although it's not very clear in the proposed rule, that for a complex case that you could get an additional 4 to 8 months in time beyond the 300 days. So you get slightly more time to deal with the really complicated cases. I would suggest that all of these proposed changes are a modest tweak to the home court advantage that the SEC gets when it tries a case in front of its own administrative law judge. You then compound those sort of procedural advantages with the fact that the judge who's presiding over the case is employed by the same employer as the prosecutor. They both work for the SEC. And if you lose in front of the ALJ, your first right of appeal is to go back to the commission, the five commissioners who approved the institution of the case in the first place. So your first right of appeal is to, again, the same agency that, you know, prosecuted you and decided that you were originally guilty.
It sounds a little like Deflategate.
You had to mention that because I'm from New England, right? and then, finally, when you do get to a constitutionally appointed judge, which would be at the federal circuit level on your second appeal, there's an incredible amount of deference that's given to the SEC's agency decision. So for all of these reasons, there have been a number of challenges to the fairness of the SEC's ALJ process. And they fall into a couple of categories of challenges. There are challenges that have been made on the grounds that it's a denial of due process or equal protection rights under the law. As a general matter, those cases have not fared well, including here in the Southern District. Courts have somewhat reluctantly said that while the process may not be entirely fair, it's not unconstitutional, and agency proceedings are well established, not just within the securities industry, but across the large body of administrative agency law. So those kind of challenges have not fared that well. There have been a couple of cases that have successfully, at least in an interim stage, challenged the SEC's process because of the manner in which the ALJs are appointed. And there are two cases in the district court in Georgia, both of them now up on appeal to the 11th Circuit. But in both of those cases, the ALJs were challenged because they were not appointed by the commissioners themselves. They were appointed by the Office of ALJs, and I think it's the Office of Personnel Management, was also involved. But there are some defects in the way in which ALJs are allegedly appointed. I think it's a pretty easy defect to fix because the commissioners can simply hire the ALJs and perhaps even do that retroactively. But at least as an interim matter, those cases have been stayed. The proceedings are not going forward until the 11th Circuit decides whether or not the umpire who's been appointed to call the balls and strikes is a legitimate umpire or not. So all of these factors have led to, I think, a very real public debate about whether or not people are getting a fair shake when the SEC decides to pursue a case against them in an administrative proceeding. I think Director Serezny has made it very clear that in his view that the use of the administrative forum is entirely proper, entirely appropriate, and eminently fair to respondents. And Kara Brockmeyer, who is the head of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Unit within the SEC, has also said publicly that, in her view, it's, quote, fair to say that bringing cases as administrative proceedings is the new normal. Andy, with all of that background, let me ask you, are we ever going to see another case filed in federal court, or is the trend of filing cases in administrative proceeding the new normal?
Well, look, if you look at 2014, I think the numbers were 57% filed in federal court and 43% in administrative proceedings. At least earlier this year when I looked at the numbers, and I don't have the up-to-date numbers, but it was something like 60% federal court, 40% APs. And I also think that a large percentage, and don't hold me to this because I don't have the numbers, but there's a good percentage of APs that are against regulated persons, which is as it's always been. I mean, that's always been the case. The question, I think the answer is right there for you. We're continuing to file cases in federal district court and by no means are shying away from it. I do think it's interesting when you look at the challenges that have actually gotten traction. I mean, the debate seems to be, or at least the debate from the defense bar side seems to be, that all these cases are challenging the fairness of the administrative proceeding, the administrative process, and yet those are precisely the arguments that have gotten absolutely no traction whatsoever. The only arguments that are there now are really separation of powers arguments. So, you know, there's a disconnect between the arguments being advocated by those who are trying to strike down, I guess, the AP process, and the public debate, which is, you know, everything is unfair. That is not the point that's being advocated in the federal courts as reasons to invalidate these procedures. I also think, in large measure, it's just very interesting. I mean, you cited, well, in 2014, we won, I guess, 100% in APs and lost a number of litigated cases in the federal court. But, you know, I could pick a slice in time where it's exactly the opposite. And I know this year we've lost, we just lost the Ruggieri case in front of an AP, which was an insider trading case. And I would also suggest that a lot of the losses that we sustain in the federal courts are also in the insider trading realm, primarily because those are the hardest cases. I mean, most of the time, they're circumstantial cases. So every once in a while, you got the smoking gun, you got the wiretap, you know, those are the cases. They're slam dunks. Most people don't litigate those cases. But the ones that are litigated are hard cases. And so that the very fact that we bring most insider trading cases in federal court probably accounts for a fair amount of the discrepancy between our record in one court or the other. But I also think another big picture point to realize is that whatever forum we're talking about, be it federal court or AP, we win most of the time, the vast majority of the time. I mean, I think if you look at statistics over time, we win 80% of the time wherever we are. So this notion, I mean, it's all based on assertions about the home advantage. And I think it's interesting, it's a bit ironic that, you know, on the one hand, we're being criticized because the judges are appointed by the commission and then deciding the commission's cases. But on the other hand, the big challenge in federal court is that the judges actually aren't appointed by the commission. They're appointed by OPM. So apparently what they're trying to do is have them appointed by the commission, which I just think is an interesting irony to the argument. But the bottom line is, there is, in every administrative proceeding, an extraordinary transparency to how the result was arrived at. I mean, you have, unlike a jury trial, where you get a verdict, and unless you're in the courtroom and able to talk to the jurors, you don't really have any idea how the jury arrived at its conclusion, what was it that was persuasive or not persuasive. With administrative proceedings, it's all right there. And if you look at any, just pick a decision, any decision, go to the Secretary's website. These are lengthy, thorough decisions that cite chapter and verse to every piece of evidence that the judge has considered and either accepted or rejected. The judges generally give their reasons for accepting or rejecting it. And I have never seen a study done, I mean, other than picking a period in time and saying, well, you won so many there and lost so many there. The study that should be done is for somebody to sit down with all those ALJ decisions and read them and then show the travesty of justice. I mean, show me how many cases where you can say the judge was biased or the judge's decision doesn't make sense after you read what the judge has to say about the evidence. And add to that, if the judge has made a mistake, show me how many times the commission hasn't reversed it. And nobody's done that study, but you know, if you really want to look at the fairness issue, let's see what folks think when they're really analyzing the actual decisions. I think you're going to get a very, very different picture. And I don't want to take too much time on this, but I do want to say, I mean, there's a big difference between litigating a civil case outside of the government context when, you're a defense lawyer, you get hit with a complaint, maybe the first time you've ever even heard of the client, so now you got to scramble to figure out, well, what's my defense, what am I going to do? When you're in an SEC investigation, most of the time, the defense lawyer, have been in that investigation from day one. You've been at every testimony. You've seen every exhibit. Then when it comes to the Wells process, we don't just ask you for your defenses. We sit down with you and we show you, or we do in New York, we show you our evidence. And we say, this is the evidence against you. And a lot of times we do it by a reverse proffer, nice PowerPoints, lay it all out, excerpting testimony, telling you exactly what the case is and then telling you, now come back and tell us why we're wrong. Very, very transparent process. And you know that it's not out of the blue, someday we just file an AP. You know whether we're going to file that case or not. And when we do, you're very, very well armed. You've already got your documents all organized. You know exactly what's coming. And on day 7, whatever you don't have, we produce to you. We produce the entire record to you. So it's not at all like an ordinary civil litigation where on day 1 you kind of don't know what end is up. You're in the thick of it on day 1 when the administrative proceeding is filed. And I think that explains why these trials can go forward on the timelines that have been set forth, because most of the time everybody is armed and ready for it. So that's my defense of the AP.
We're running a little bit short on time, but Andy, I want to just pick up on what you said about the insider trading cases being the hard cases and ask you to spend just a minute talking about one recent hard case, last year's ruling by the Second Circuit in United States against Newman, which made it more difficult to bring insider trading cases against tippees. And a lot of people have said that the Newman approach gives hedge funds license to make improper use of inside information. But of course, Newman is a criminal case. Can you tell us a little bit about the impact of Newman, particularly with respect to your ability to bring civil enforcement actions for insider trading?
Sure. So, and I guess, again, in the prep session, one of the questions Mary Jo asked me was, so how is it different now? What do you do differently? And my answer is, we haven't changed a thing. I mean, you get the case, you get it in the same way, and you start investigating it in the same way. And the main difference is that now we've got another element that's kind of, fuzzy right now. We're not exactly sure what it all means, but it's this benefit concept that Newman has kind of defined in a bit of a murky way. And so that becomes an area on which we need to put focus, whereas in the past we didn't have to focus on it in that same way. So it seems to me, in developing these cases, that's really the only thing that's changed. I mean, we've just got to be aware now that we've got another element we've got to look at. You point out that a civil case is different from a criminal case. So, for example, Newman says that in a criminal case, the tippee needs to know that the information was obtained illegally. but not in our cases. In our cases, it's either knew or should have known. So if we can get the inference that, you know, on its face, it looks like something that was probably obtained illegally, that should do it for us. The other element of Newman that really doesn't exist in most cases is, you know, that was in one stock, I guess, a third and fourth level tippee, and in the other it was pure fourth level tippee. So you're very far down the chain there. And obviously, you know, the farther down the chain you go, the harder it is to prove the case even without the benefit issue. I mean, even without the benefit analysis, that's a harder case to prove. You know, most of your cases are not like that. That's not to say that we're not going to do those cases, but most of your insider trading cases are not multiple layers removed from the source. So a lot of the issues that Newman raises, the complexities that seemingly are raised in Newman, probably are not going to be there. I think in a lot of ways, you know, when Newman came down, it did cause quite a stir, but as the dust begins to settle, and putting aside whatever the Supreme Court may decide to do, I think the case law is already developing around Newman. It's already telling us what Newman means. And you're getting, you know, another ironic point. The only adverse decision we've had under Newman was by one of our ALJs a couple of weeks ago, who dismissed one of our cases on the benefit.
It's on appeal to your commissioners.
It's on appeal. That's right. Most of the law that's been coming out since Newman has been very favorable to us in terms of defining the kinds of relationships that are needed. I mean, I think that, you know, and this is not entirely crystal clear, but, I mean, as I'm reading it, you've kind of got three buckets. One is like the traditional friendship. I don't think that's disturbed, and even our ALJ gave us that. I think you've also got this intention to benefit, and, you know, there's a little bit of question about exactly what that means, but I think arguably it means that if you can show that the tipper intended that the tippy trade, that will probably suffice, we'll see. And then you've got, you know, this other more complex area, which is really what Newman was dealing with, which is the area of the business relationship and exactly, you know, how much flesh there needs to be on that in order to satisfy the benefit standard. So we'll see what the cases do there, but I'm kind of optimistic. I mean, I think the case law since Newman has been developing more or less in an appropriate way, in a way that hasn't really inhibited us. I expect that it will continue in that way.
Mary Jo, did you have any follow-up on that?
Just one question. Because a lot of the firms are really faced with trying to ensure that they have adequate compliance procedures in place, and just like the SEC staff, they don't know what's going to come out at the end of the day in terms of what the Supreme Court may do around this issue. What is your view about whether Newman means that firms need to be thinking differently or modifying their approach to compliance procedures around trading?
So before I answer that, I realize that I forgot to do something very important, which is at the very beginning, I should have said that the views I'm expressing today are my views only and don't reflect the views of the commission or the staff. But I think the answer to the question is you should not change your approach to compliance based on Newman, because, as I say, we're not really changing our approach to the way we investigate these cases.
Thanks, Andy. I was going to prompt you when I got to my closing remarks if you hadn't given your disclaimer, because I noticed that was missing too. We are coming to the end of our discussion, Mary Jo, Andy, and Tim, I want to thank you very much for sharing your insights. I hope that the audience, both gathered here in New York and listening online, found this to be an informative discussion. I certainly did. I think we've learned a lot about the current burning issues at the SEC. This program will also add to the valuable body of knowledge in the program series. The audio of this broadcast will be available soon in the virtual museum and archive, and an edited transcript will be added later. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I'd like to thank Morgan Lewis again for their sponsorship and their hospitality in making today's program possible. Thank you all for joining us, and good evening.